Welcome to the Creativity Cafe for the creatively adventurous and the relentlessly curious.
We have inspiring conversations with creative women from all over the world.
I'm Paige Baldwinando, and I'm a creativity coach who helps people maximize their creative potential, and I'm also a writer.
And I'm Jordana Matsuda. I'm an illustrator on my creative journey, with Paige helping me along the way.
We're both long-term residents of Japan, a country bursting with creative energy that inspires us every day.
So go grab a cup of tea and join us in discovering new creative landscapes here on the Creativity Cafe.
Hi, Jordana.
Hi, Paige.
So I'm curious. I know you love interiors and you love just the joy of having beautiful items in your home and in your daily life. I'm curious to hear about some of them. Like, what are some of the things that you have in your home that you just love, that bring you joy?
Yeah, I think there's two that pop into my mind straight away. One is a mug, and it's like a saucer slash plate, because it's like, it's wavy and it's like very like organically shaped. So it could be a plate, it could be a saucer. And anyway, the cup and the saucer, they match. It's a set, but it's very, it's not, you know, afternoon tea type of cup and saucer. It's more like organic kind of casual style. And it's in my favorite color. It's like that kind of sea blue greenish kind of color. And I just love it. I love using it. It's just really pretty, and it just brings me that little bit of joy every morning when I pour my coffee into it. And I got that from a local coffee shop they don't anymore. They used to sell like pottery made by like local to Kanto, I guess, not local to our area. Their products in their shop. So it was really lovely. I really love using that. And I really don't let anybody else use it.
Right. It's yours.
Yes, it really is mine.
Totally. Yes.
I think the other one, it's a bit divisive in our house, because I love it, but my husband and son think it's weird. So I think you've seen it as well. I have a vase. So for my birthday one year, my mother-in-law gave us some money, and I was like, what should I buy? I want to buy something special. And I'd seen these vases for a few years, and I was like, okay, I'm going to buy one for myself. And it's a vase, and it looks, the top, it's hard to explain, isn't it? The top half is like a face, and then the bottom half is like the body. It's very like Scandinavian style.
And
it's so like, it's really nice, the really nice pattern. I love it. I love it so much. And when you put the flowers in, it looks like, you know, her hair. So, you know, the combination of the wonderful vase with the flowers is just really magical. But my husband's like, that's just kind of weird. Why is she looking at me like that? It's a bit scary. And I'm like, it's really lovely. I love it. Every time I put flowers in it, it fills me with joy. So that's it's always interesting in our house in that sense. My husband and I have very different taste. So,
those things can be definitely like topics of conversation long term. Why do you have this thing?
If it's just a vase, he's like, yeah, okay, whatever. He doesn't mind. But if it's like, you know, wallpaper or, you know, other major things, it's tricky. But they're my two things that I use every day that I just love to have around me.
Lovely.
How about you? Do you have anything like that?
I do. Yes. Actually, one of mine is also a vase that so I need to tell a little bit of background first. When I was 20, I went and lived for a year in Copenhagen, Denmark. And at that time, I stayed with a host family who were just the most wonderful people, who took me in as a family member and taught me Danish and helped me just become more of myself. You know, I just felt very much that I was part of the family and I was loved in that context. And for many, many years, even now, I kept in close touch with that family. And when I had my son, the year he was born or the year after he was born, they came to visit Japan. And when they came, they brought me this set. One is a it's a vase and a fruit bowl together. Beautiful Scandinavian glassware. They're this very pale blue color that I love. And every single time I use either one of them, well, the fruit bowl lives on our counter, so we use it every day. But especially when I use the vase, when the vase comes out, I think of her, I think
Yeah.
of her. That especially my host mother, who I know picked it, right? She is someone who loves me in such a an uncomplicated way and an unconditional way that when I'm using this beautiful thing that she gave me, I feel connected to her and I remember how she loves me. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's really beautiful.
So that's one thing. And then the other is this mug I have. I actually have two mugs that I love, one of which you gave me. I think it's from Marks and Spencer. It's just a very simple but really lovely mug. And the handle of it has like a heart shape, to it. And again, every time I use it, I think of you. I think, oh, this is, my friend, my beloved friend gave this to me,
That's lovely.
And the other is a mug that another good friend gave to me, and it says on it, I love this so much, never underestimate a well-read woman.
Oh, yes. That's
Because,
very appropriate for you as well.
yeah, I may or may not be a massive nerd. I read a lot. So, yeah, it just those things, make me feel loved and seen and understood. And every time I use them, there's this reminder, of there are people in the world who are not here in this room with me who love me, who've gone out. And I'm not really a gift person generally. I'm not, that whole thing about love languages and how you like receive love. Gifts tend not to be the way I prefer to receive love, but these gifts have felt to me like just incredibly loving gifts from people who know me and know what I like and thought about that when they chose these things. You know what I mean?
So that's special meaning, doesn't it? It's not just a an object.
Yeah, exactly. It's not about the object at all. It's really about the feeling behind it. Yeah. So yeah, today's guest is someone who is very interested in this concept and this reality, right, of bringing a relationship to the items that we use every day and really fostering that love, that connection, that joy that comes from the objects in our homes.
Yeah, and she has so much passion, and she draws so much inspiration from the world around her. And you can really, when you look at her objects, I've not, unfortunately, I've not held any, but like when you look at the objects, you can really feel that sense of nature and that sense of being at one kind of with the objects whenever, I've looked at her items.
Yeah, they're really beautiful. She brings in like a just a real sense of connectedness to the items themselves. You can feel her connectedness with the items themselves. And I really appreciate her work, the way she the sensibility that she brings to her work and the way nature comes into her work. It's quite lovely and really everything she makes, including the YouTube videos she makes, other things that she has done in her life, including fashion related things. You just really feel in viewing her work and in experiencing her work that she has a profound sense of connectedness to what she does. So, with all that in mind, let's take a listen to our conversation with our guest today, Laura Pearson. Okay, Originally from Scotland, ceramicist Laura Pearson has lived in Japan for 8 years. Now based in Shonan Kamakura, a seaside town about an hour from Tokyo, Laura creates unique homeware pieces that center the user's connection with the items they use every day. Paying mind to the textural and sensory experiences people have when using her pieces, Laura hopes to bring joy to people's everyday lives as they undertake daily rituals, like drinking a cup of coffee. The organic forms and textures of her pieces evoke the forms and textures of the natural world and allow their users to form a connection with each of them as unique works of functional art. With a background in textiles, costume, and fashion design, Laura also hopes to incorporate her past experiences into fabric homewares for her brand in the future. Welcome to the Creativity Cafe, Laura.
Hi.
Hello.
Hello. Nice to
Oh.
have you.
Oh, thank you so much.
Yes. Yeah, I'm so excited. I've seen so many of your videos online and what have you.
Oh.
Yeah, so I'm like, oh, who is the person behind this lovely voice? Soft and gentle. Yeah, it's
Oh.
mesmerizing. So.
Yeah. I'm going for a kind of relaxed feel, that's for sure. I just want somewhere relaxed that people can go and think about
Yeah.
art. Really, that's the goal.
Yeah, well, I think yeah, you're hitting it, so that's
Thank
good.
you.
So, Laura, on each episode, we ask all our guests the same question to start off with. So, can you tell us what's your first memory of doing something creative?
I don't know what exactly the first memory is, but I think that from a very young age, I was definitely drawing and painting, and I just wanted to do that all the time, really. And when I was a little bit older, I really was obsessed with miniature things. I loved the borrowers, so I would create little dioramas inside shoe boxes of like underwater scenes or like house interiors. And I would make little people out of paper and cut them out and put them in my pocket and take them around with me everywhere.
Oh, that's so cute.
How lovely.
I actually still like miniatures and dioramas and things like that. I'm still obsessed with that.
Yeah, there's something so mesmerizing about looking at a miniaturized world. You know, if you go to a place that has a diorama or like a big setup of a miniaturized world, like I'm thinking of, I can't remember where it was that I saw like a miniaturized Tokyo, basically, and you could see all the little people and the little cars and the Ferris wheel, you know, just things like that. I could look at that all day.
Tokyo is actually a great place for that kind of thing. There's so many the unexpected in an unexpected museum, you'll find,
Yes.
these little things.
Oh, so when as it takes its form now, what do you find yourself interested in terms of miniatures?
I wouldn't say that I'm doing anything really miniature based, but I do have like a few books at home that are just filled with artists who make things out of miniatures. And I just, I like to look at those kinds of things. And also just with my kids, I'm putting those sort of ideas in their head as well, I guess. And like getting them to look at nature a bit more close up and imagine things, just looking at insects and imagining like being that small, or it's quite a fun idea.
It is interesting because like from as someone who works in a very 2D way, I do struggle to think in a 3D way. But like when I th listening to you now and you the work you're making now, like it is more 3D, isn't it? It seems like it's coming from that the spatial awareness is kind of linked to a lot of your work, it seems.
Yeah, definitely. It's making something that's quite usable, like you can wear it or you can use it. I think that's what I like to do. When I was studying textile design, again, it's quite flat, but I just wanted to make it 3D and make it something else, give it a little bit more texture and make it not just seem like a flat piece of cloth, you know.
Yeah.
And that's what led me to wanting to make things out of cloth more, I think, than making the cloth itself. Yeah.
Right. So will you tell us a bit more about your path towards where you are today as an artist? You've had a really interesting road.
Yeah, I've done a lot of things, I guess. I've been to lots of places and done lots of things. I've been really lucky in that. So I grew up in or near Dundee in Scotland, and I studied textile design at Duncan of Jordanston Art College in Dundee. And I completed a bachelor's degree there, but I hadn't done the full 4 years. It was 3 years, I think. And I moved on to the second year of performance costume in Edinburgh, because I kind of had this realization that I wanted to make clothes, as I was just saying. So that's what I did. I went in and then, yeah, I somehow managed to get 2 degrees that way. I don't know if everyone knows that you can do that, but I was lucky. I studied patterning, and I was able to actually use my textile knowledge there as well and create a lot of the textiles that I used in my garments for the performance costume pieces. And even then I was obsessed with Japan, and I'd look at all the textures and the textiles that were, you know, traditionally Japanese, and I stuck on shibori, which is tie-dyeing process. And I actually wrote my dissertation on that, and I used shibori processes in my costume design. So when I graduated from costume, I had like a 6-month period studying fashion in Milan as part of my course, and I ended up moving into fashion. It's quite difficult to get into costume, and you're kind of working as a freelancer, and I think it's difficult to keep jobs coming in, if you know what I mean. You have to be in the right circles. I ended up going into fashion. And that was hard because I actually was living in Beijing straight out of university with my now husband, who studied Chinese. So that's why we moved to China. I was working basically as a freelance fashion designer with foreign fashion companies that wanted to work in China and with Chinese manufacturers. So I was there for about 3.5 years. Sorry, this is going to get really long.
That's okay.
I was there for about 3.5 years doing that. Moved to Hong Kong, did the same kind of thing. It became more of a bespoke fashion, menswear. And then from there, that kind of led me into women's wear in London. Making bespoke things for, you know, parties, and also I made wedding dresses for a different company as well. So mainly fashion since graduating. After I moved to Japan, I did a bit of my own fashion design. I actually started making clothes for my kids, and that led me to sort of selling those designs, and that was really a hard time for me because I was kind of a bit sick of fashion at that point, and making all the different sizes and all the patterns for everything, and the amount of work that you put in to sell one piece is a lot, and you have to spend a lot of money on all the fabrics, and I was hand printing things, and it was work for not much gain. So it was a really nice time that I was able to make things for my kids, and they actually treasure the things that I made for them still, even if they're too small for them. They know that, like, the toys and things that I made for them as well, that was they still remember that I did it, and that's really nice. But after I moved down to Kamakura, it was kind of the pandemic hit, and I was looking for something new to do, basically. And that's what led me into making pottery and learning all the things I have done to do with pottery. So, yeah, it's a bit of a long story.
No, it's so interesting to hear, like, you know, all the different, you know, paths that you've walked to get to where you are today.
Yeah, and who knows where it's going to go. You know,
well, that's the beauty of it. Yeah,
still
that's
early days for me in pottery.
So what was it that, like, attracted you to pottery? Like, how did you kind of start doing that once you got to Kamakura?
When I was doing fashion, I'd always kind of had the idea, oh, it'd be nice to try making some pottery. But, you know, I was kind of put off by that idea from some of my peers. They were thinking, oh, no, you should stay in fashion, blah, 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 you know. So I never ended up doing anything about it. And when I moved to Japan, it's like an avalanche of pottery.
You know,
I'd be eating at my mother-in-law's, and there'd be so many plates at the end of the meal, all these little plates for different dishes. And it just fascinated me, the connection that Japanese people have to pottery in their everyday lives. And I started to learn about Japanese pottery. And I think that's where the love for it really came, and I wanted to try making it myself. Yeah.
Yeah, because we are surrounded, hey, by such beautiful pottery everywhere. So I can completely understand that motivation.
Yeah. It really is everywhere, and it really is integrated into everyday life in such a way that I think is quite distinct from what we are used to in the Western world, you know?
Yeah. I mean, we kind of think of the mug as like the one thing that's special to us that we use, and it's like our own, you know, that no one else can use. But I feel like in Japan, that idea of mugs is just not there, and it's almost like a lesser form of pottery, and they don't want to spend too much money on it. And it's just it's so interesting, because there's so many different, you know, uses for the little plates and all the different types of pottery that are here. So I'm learning all of that as well.
Because I still find that I'm like, okay, I don't really understand what this plate is like for, you know, what is the function of this type of plate, you know, when I'm seeing it in a shop or even in my mother-in-law's house, I don't necessarily know what each type of or size of or shape of plate is, you know. I still see it being used, and then I'm like, oh, okay, that's for whatever it is, you know, that's for wasabi, that's for whatever. You know, I most of the time I'm like, well, it's a cute little plate, that's what I
I'm with you.
I'm wondering now, Laura, because like when I think like in England, in the UK, you know, there is kind of like rules of this plate's for, you know, bread, and this plate's for this. Do you know, because I don't really know, in Japan, do plates have specific functions, or is it just you use it to what fits whatever you're eating? Do you know? Sorry, put you on the spot about that, but
do you know?
Yeah.
I think there's an idea of what size plate goes with what kind of dish, for sure. My mother-in-law will always be like, you want to use that plate for this piece of cake?
Okay, you know? So there is some underlying I don't do's know. And don'ts.
I mean, I'm not with like really traditional Japanese people every day, so I'm still learning all this and trying to gate and, you know, engage with my customers about that kind of thing as well. It's a difficult one, but I do feel there's a lot more variety, whereas maybe it's quite relaxed in the UK. And yeah, there is like the, you know, cereal bowl and a plate for toast and a dinner plate and a soup bowl. But, you know, there's, yeah, I don't know. I feel like there's more here.
Yeah.
There's more I have to learn about it as well.
Definitely. So, Laura, can you tell us, you know, we heard you live down in Shonan Kamakura. Can you tell us, how has living in that area amid that, you know, beautiful natural beauty, how has it impacted your work?
Well, first of all, I was really lucky to move down here just before the pandemic, because we actually have a view, which we didn't have. So even though we were staying at home, we felt very lucky to have this view, which we didn't have in Tokyo. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, nature's always been a big inspiration for me, and it was part of the reason for moving down here to the coast, because I grew up on the coast of Scotland. So I felt more at home and at peace near the ocean. There's also lots of really beautiful hill trails around Kamakura. And that's something else that I used to do as a kid with my mum and dad, is just go walking at the weekends. And it's really nice to be able to do that with my kids as well. So, yeah, being able to experience these things every day really did kind of filter down into my work quite directly, because I made a point of, you know, doing that more when I was learning about pottery. And it became very therapeutic, the whole thing, kind of related to making pottery and just experiencing nature in a different way. I feel like being in Japan, I've never felt so touched and astounded by nature as I do now, because it's so ingrained in the culture here. And I never really thought about it that deeply before coming to live in Japan. Everything's seasonal. People know about what's growing, when, and when you should eat certain things. And you go out into nature, and every week there's something new to look at. And it was just, I don't know, it just felt really, it felt very different here than in Scotland. And I'm not saying Scotland's barren, it's very beautiful as well, but I didn't think about it in the same way as I do now, I think. And also the insects here. there's hardly any insects in Scotland, I feel. Now I'm so like seeing something new every day, and I'm like, what the heck is that? They're so weird, some of them.
It's so true. I'm living with 4 beetles in my house. So I completely understand them. Yes.
Those are your sons.
My sons, yeah.
That was something that shocked me when I first came here, how, you know, in the summertime you'll see in stores like the selling of beetles as pets. I was like, what?
He found these ones in his school. I think, you know, that's, I think we, Paige and I've had this conversation before as well, like Japan does the season so well, because maybe just because, you know, they grow so much food, and there's so many different types of flowers, you know, the exposure is so visual each season, isn't it? That,
yeah, it's very,
you
lush.
Know, our awareness, yeah, so lush. Our awareness of it is, you know, much heightened compared to back in the UK, for sure.
Yeah. Mm. And I started learning the Japanese tea ceremony when I started making chawans, because I wanted to really understand the use of a chawan. And it was one of my favorite forms to make. So I thought, I better, you know, understand these utensils before I actually try and make them myself properly. And when studying the tea ceremony, it's everything's linked to nature. And every time I do my class, something new about nature comes up, and it's so amazing. It's so inspiring for me. Yeah.
Will you explain what a chawan is for listeners outside Japan who might not know?
Yeah, of course. So a chawan is a tea bowl that is used specifically for the Japanese tea ceremony to drink matcha from.
And they're quite amazing, actually. There's so many different ways.
There's a lot. It's a big variety of styles in Japan. Mm-hmm. But there's a hierarchy of now you put me on the spot if you ask me what the hierarchy is, but there's a certain hierarchy of styles for the tea ceremony. I think the highest one is raku chawans, and then it's hagi and karatsu. I think also there's a few other styles that are lesser ranked, as it were. There's the different shapes for summer and winter, and it's a lot to learn.
So I, maybe about 5 years ago, I did just a few tea ceremony lessons, and it's obviously the first time to do it, and I really loved that the bit where the person who was leading the ceremony would explain why they chose that chawan and where it's from and who made it and like what they loved about it, and you know, they got so specific about that chawan, and it was really intriguing to hear the story behind it. And because everybody uses the same bowl, don't they? So
I think things have changed a little bit because of coronavirus.
I guess
and now we're using separate bowls, and I make one for each person. Before, definitely that was the case, where they would pass it around.
Oh, I wonder if that will change forever. I wonder if they'll ever go back to doing just the one bowl after, you know, however many centuries.
I think it might be like that. Yeah, it might be like that forever now.
Yeah, it's interesting how, you know, culturally that would be, you know, quite significant, wouldn't it, within the tea ceremony world?
Definitely.
And even, you know, going in and wearing a mask, that was mandatory for everyone for a long time. Now we are not required to do that, but just remembering to take your mask off before you try and drink the tea.
Maybe awkward.
Laura, you mentioned that you are very drawn to like texture and surface pattern design, especially coming from your background in fashion. So I'm curious, like, what part do those elements of texture and surface design play in your exploration through ceramics?
So I mentioned before that I just felt this deeper connection and love for nature since moving to Japan. And I was bringing flowers into my home, and I was finding this all so satisfying to bring nature inside, and I felt like I could do that with my pottery as well. And kind of I wanted to steer away from sort of the look of like perfect mass produced items, and have something that was quite organic. I feel like we often use sort of flat mass-produced looking things, and our homes are like, you know, boxes basically. So I just felt like it's important to bring nature inside just to kind of juxtapose against that setting, if you know what I mean.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, one of the things I noticed when I not too long ago went to meet you in person in Shonan Kita Kamakura, right? And I noticed like the amazing cliffs, like, or the rock formations there. I don't even know what to call them necessarily, because I'm not that familiar with geology. But
I think it's limestone. I'm actually not sure what it is either. I need to ask someone Japanese.
I was so moved by the textural. in that environment, I just found the textural beauty so appealing and so, I don't know, moving. I'm also from a part of North America that is very rocky. Like where I grew up, there's a lot of stone and rock formations. And even though that's the case, I don't know that much about them, but I just found those formations really beautiful and I had trouble like stopping looking at them. I just wanted to keep looking at them. So I was curious if that's part of your inspiration as well, like some of those features of the natural landscape.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. They're everywhere and they kind of hold the town. They're surrounding all these buildings. And actually my house is built on top of a rock formation like that. So it really affected my pottery as well, just seeing that every day. So I try to recreate those rock textures in my pottery as well. And that's sort of another way for me to bring nature, natural textures inside my home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's very beautifully emerging in your work. You know, when I look at your work, especially looking at it in person and getting to hold it, I feel that influence there.
Thank you.
Yeah.
So as we mentioned at the beginning, Laura, you make lovely videos on YouTube. So your videos are so inviting and so beautiful. What drew you to video as a medium?
Thank you so much. That means a lot to me. I watch a lot of YouTube. I like the background noise of people. I find it very comforting. So when I'm working, I always have YouTube on and people that I know on YouTube kind of just talking in the background. And I guess I kind of grew up with that, with like TV on in the background, you know. And so I became kind of fascinated with what was popular on YouTube, and I wanted to understand the algorithm a little bit, I guess. And it's very human thing, I think. And I just wanted to understand it a little bit better. But I still don't understand it. And you know, like by doing it, hopefully, eventually, I will be able to be better at it and also understand what is successful on YouTube. I think it's a great way to put the word out about your business, because video is, I think people engage with video more. It's more contact with, you know, human faces, and I think video is very, very engaging for people. And I've been planning on starting a YouTube channel for years, but I just it didn't seem the right time. I didn't know what I was going to be making things about. But since learning all the things that I have been recently, I just felt like I had a lot of things to put down and document. And it's a way for me to solidify what I've learned, and for myself to just kind of look back on in the years of, so I can remember what it's like being in this place here now in Japan as well. Because I don't know if I'll be in Japan forever. It was a way for me to put everything together and document it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's really lovely. The videos are lovely and very inspiring to watch. Yeah.
Also, Japan is a great place for small businesses, creative individuals like yourselves, and I wanted to highlight those people that I've met in Japan, and I wanted to I'm going to be making more videos about those small businesses as well, and helping those people get seen and recognition for what they do. There really is some amazing artists and small businesses in Japan.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many people doing really interesting things and beautiful things, innovative things, you know. Yeah.
I really love watching film, and I feel like if I have a topic for the video, it's like creating a small film. And I don't know anything about filmmaking, but it became kind of project based, and it was almost quite intuitive for me to put these images with music that I liked that went with the image, and then I was writing the story for, you know, each little video, each project. Yeah, so it kind of came about quite easily for me. I don't know, I felt very satisfied after making each video, and I almost feel like crying after I make each video because it means so much to me. And I don't feel like that when I finish a piece of pottery. So I don't know, it's continue doing it. I'm getting a lot of enjoyment out of making the videos.
Oh, wow. It's really wonderful to hear you talk about, you know, this form of, you know, and a different form of your creative outlet in a different way. Hey, Paige, really noticed that how Laura's way of talking about the film. Yeah, this different sense of emotion there. And I think, you know, as a viewer, you can really sense the passion for what either you're exploring in your local area or what you're making. Like you did the kind of process videos of how you make like your mugs or different things that you're making. I'm so captivated. It's like mesmerizing, you know, the combination. You know, obviously you put that thought, you know, listening to you now, the thought you've put into it, you know, combining the music with kind of the narrative that you've created and the visual. It's just it's mesmerizing. It's very calming.
Oh, thank you so much. No, I'm really proud of it, and it was kind of you know, an unexpected thing that I decided to make an introduction video for myself, and that was maybe the most awkward one because I had to look at my face and edit my speaking voice for a long time for that one. But it became like making a short film, and I could think about it in a different way. And I'm quite proud of my videos that I've made so far. So.
Yeah, you should be. Yeah. You should be.
Thanks.
So Laura, you mentioned on your website, I was checking through your website, which is also beautiful, by the way. And I found there that you noticed, you cited the Buddhist nun Otagaki Rengetsu as one of your influences. And I hadn't heard of her before. So I went down a bit of a rabbit hole researching, and just what a fascinating human. Just
really, my God. Yeah. Really kindest person. So as I mentioned before, I was really looking at antique Japanese ceramics, and it's mainly men. It's a very driven industry, and I'm encouraged to find this like beautiful female. Back in the Edo period, was making these organic forms, and she kind of became very famous for her style of pottery, and she combined two really, which is calligraphy and poetry with her pottery process. It was really inspiring to hear about her life. She went through so many hardships, and everything that she came across, she did it with such humility. People were stealing her designs, and she would let them, basically, just so they would have an income, and she would actually draw her poetry on their pottery, and you know, she would just came across this. That wasn't such a hardship. She went through a lot of terrible things, but everything that she came across, she seemed to tackle it with just kindness and humility. So yeah, she was very inspirational for me.
Yeah, I think you know, when you look at her poetry and also and her ceramics, there is this organic flow. This a flowy feeling to what she makes and the way it, I don't know, emerges. Like it just feels very
accessible and enjoyable, like to be around. You know, there isn't this feeling of, oh, it's so elevated, I can't go near it, right? There's this accessibility to it.
I think definitely her humble sort of flowed through into her pottery, and she never really thought too much about her work, I don't think. And she would apologize for how clumsy it was when she was bringing them into markets, and she I think she really was connected with the Japanese and at one time when people went to Kyoto, they would bring back an Otagaki Rengetsu piece. So that was what was cited that popular, and I think it was a lot to do with her poetry as well. Having these organs in the tea ceremony with the tree, it was so special. And I think her work was very influential for a lot of people.
Yeah, I can see why. I really can.
Laura, can you tell us a little bit about a project you're currently working on or currently excited about?
I love interior design, and I want to bring that into my business more. So I hope to combine my textile and sewing knowledge and make more homewares for my brand. That's one thing. But also we just started a renovation project in Mashiko, which is a park just outside of Tokyo. And also lends itself to me doing more interior design and bringing the products that I make into a space. And hopefully one day it'll be a place where we can either rent out or have as a gallery or shop space. So that's a big project that I don't quite know if it's going to turn out, but it's exciting.
Wow. Yeah, I love, anybody who listens to the podcast knows I love interior design. I love looking at it. I'm not good at doing it. I just love to look at beautiful interiors. So that sounds really exciting.
It's a lot. Another huge thing to learn. It's really difficult for me. I mean, I like putting things together in space, but like actually doing interior design from scratch and laying things out in, you know, in a thoughtful way for a client is something completely different, you know. So I hope to in the future, I mean, my dream is to make art pieces that go with an interior that I've designed. If you can imagine, that would just be so amazing to go in and be able to make the pieces that go into an interior space. Yeah. that would be my dream.
Yeah.
Really cool. And it seems like part of what really pulls you or draws you is like this idea of making functional things, you know, that people are going to use every day. Would you say that's accurate?
Definitely. Yeah. I want to affect people's lives in a positive way with what I produce. And that's the main goal that I've always had in my head, no matter what I've been making. When I was doing my bespoke women's fashion, I would be working directly with the customer and hearing their design ideas, working with them to design it and actually making it for them, doing all the fittings for them as well. And then just the gratification and the satisfaction that I got from making these people's dreams come true and making them so happy. With something that's been specifically created for them by me. I can't explain how good that feels, and I just want to continue along that path with everything I do. It's just really, I want it to be about the experience and helping people to, I don't know, I guess now it's aimed towards getting people to think about nature and going out into nature and bringing that into their home. Spending, I think even though the pandemic's kind of over, I'm still living the same life I was, still at home most of the time. I don't know, I guess for other people it's changed, but I definitely feel a stronger connection with my home. And I feel like to make it like the nicest, comfortable pan is important for me.
Yeah, and to help other people do that must be so gratifying too, you know.
Well, I hope to, yeah, in the future. Let's see. Yeah.
Even now, the things you make, I think, do create an impact on the space that they're in, and they're lovely. So
I do a collaboration with one of my friends who makes soaps. She's from Mexico, and she does these copalera ceremonies where she burns copal in the ceramic copalera that I've made for her. So we pair the two together, and she's got a really great customer base in Kamakura especially, and her customers were so happy that she'd, you know, found me to make like vessels for their ceremony experiences, you know. So yeah, I hear from those people who are kind of connected with that type of pottery as well, and it makes me very happy to hear that what I'm making is affecting people's lives and that they use it every day. It's good.
Yeah.
That's what I want.
Yeah. So Laura, when you have, you know, you do so many things creatively, I'm curious, like when you are feeling at some point sort of out of sync with your creative flow and things are just not going the way you would like, what's something that you do to help guide yourself back?
You know, some days you just can't do anything. And then that's quite normal. Yeah. But to get back on track, I guess I just make a plan. I make a list of things that need to get done. And then I just get on with doing something towards completing that plan or that list. But I also let myself deviate from the plan when it feels right. If I need to scrap something entirely, I just do it, and I just keep working in that way, just keep setting deadlines for myself and making a plan and trying to get things done when I feel like I can, if you know what I mean. I have a lot of commitments on a daily basis. I'm with my kids for half the day, so I can't punish myself if I don't get something done on time or at all. I just have to keep moving on, and just go with what. So it's a very busy time in my life with two young kids, but it's also really exciting and rewarding. So I'm just better at all these different things and keep working on completing things.
Well, it's working for you. Whatever you're doing is working for you.
Yes. I do struggle with being overwhelmed quite a lot. Mm-hmm. And starting something new can be a struggle for me, but if I just push to start a task, then I often obsess and finish it until, you know, I try and get it done. Because I get into it, you know?
Right, yeah.
And I can just tackle things a day at a time and, yeah, move on to something else if it doesn't work out.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much for this conversation. It's been so lovely speaking with you.
Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. It's really great to speak with lots of lovely creative people like yourselves. And I was so happy to... from my friend, so it's great.
Yeah, thank you for being with us.
And Before you go, Laura, can you just let everyone listening know where can they find you online if they want to find out about your beautiful work?
My website is www.oceanridgekiln.com, and my handle for YouTube is at Ocean Ridge Kiln, and the same for Instagram and Facebook.
Okay, great. I'll put links in the notes, show notes as well. So if anyone just wants to pop in there, they can go click through and have a look at everything you're up to. Thank you so
Thank
much
you.
for joining us today, Laura. It's lovely to get to know you.
Thank you. Great to
Thank
speak with you.
you.
Now it's time for our Ask Us Anything section. This is where we answer questions that listeners have submitted. So, Paige, can you tell us what's today's question?
Yes, this question comes from Miranda in Seattle, and she is asking, what do you do when you have so many creative ideas and you don't know what to do first? It's a great question.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. So have you experienced this like overwhelming, like I want to do this and I want to do that and I don't even know where to begin?
Yeah, I feel like I'm constantly in that state, to be
Yeah.
honest. To start off with, like action begets actions. You just choose one thing and start that thing. And then if you feel like, this isn't really going how I want it to, then you can like move on to the other thing. But a good, I think for me, a good starting point usually is to just do that. It's like brains just write all the ideas down. I like to just write everything down, all the ideas or projects or whatever it is I want to do. So it's on paper. And I think there's something about getting it out on paper, be it a drawing or a list or whatever it is that works for you. Gives you a bit more clarity. Or for me anyway, I get more clarity as opposed to just thinking about it or what have you.
Exactly. It's not around in your head. Yeah.
But yeah, my next but that but then my next problem is I stop and start lots of projects, and I feel like I'm just doing musical chairs with my art projects.
Even so, if that's the case, like I think it's also okay to have quite a few irons in the fire. It does, I think anytime we are grappling with a sense of overwhelm, part of what really helps is exactly what you're saying is to go to this point of like, okay, so I'm just gonna lay it all out, almost like dumping a puzzle box on the table, right?
Yes, exactly.
And then what have I got? And then if we take that metaphor a step further, like where are my corner pieces? Where are my edge pieces? Right? Like what feels like the easiest thing to do? Or like
Yeah,
most comfortable?
that's a good starting point, isn't it?
Yeah, because with overwhelm, what's happening is we just are like totally feeling like it's too hard a lot of the time. That's the feeling underneath it is like it's so hard and I don't know what to do, and I think if we start easy and then yes, the irons in the fire that can become a place where it's easy to get even more overwhelmed. And I think in that case, it's also totally okay to take one or two of the irons out for a while. Also, sometimes once we start, we notice, oh, this project isn't as compelling as I thought it was going to be. Or maybe this can actually be folded into this other one. Maybe what I wanted to do in this one, in project A, can actually some part of that can make itself part of project B.
So that's the thing. I think once you start working on all those different ideas, that's when you realize what works, what doesn't work. Hey, and you don't know that until you started. So yeah, like I always feel a bit like, oh God, I've still not finished that thing. But yeah, I think just being okay with that, learning to be okay with, okay, right now I'm going to work on this and I'll come back to that, next week or what have you. Or when I get bored with this thing. Or when you're whatever.
And I think it's also okay to give ourselves permission to be doing lots of things at once and not to find everything equally compelling. I think in many ways we have this overarching cultural idea that there should be one thing we choose and we stick to it forever. And like, we're super dedicated to that and we're devoted to that. But for most of us, or I don't know about most of us, but for many of us, the reality is that's just not how we work. We yeah. like lots of things. Yes. We like to do lots of things at once. Focusing on one thing is probably a very useful strategy for many people, but it doesn't mean it works for all people. And it's okay if it doesn't work for you, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think when you combine that with our like productivity culture, yes. it can feel overwhelming, and you can feel like you're not doing enough. Mm-hmm. So I think not putting any time pressure on yourself as well really helps to enjoy the process more as well. If you know you're constantly thinking about all your projects and getting them done by a certain time, you know, you start to lose the joy of making whatever it is you're making.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think you make such a good point about productivity culture, because it's also like, you know, we are not a product. You're not a product. I'm not a product. What we're making is not a product, unless, you know, we decide that it is, but we don't owe the world our incessant work. You know, we don't have to be workhorses.
Yes.
We're allowed to enjoy. We're allowed to make for the joy of making. We're allowed to make just because we feel like it. We're allowed to make for any reason whatsoever. And we don't have to prove anything to anyone.
Yeah, exactly. And I think maybe sometimes the language, I know you often talk about this, Paige, the language we use around the work we're doing. Like I've recently been trying to tell myself not to, I'm producing art, or I'm working on my art, but rather I'm creating, or I'm making. I don't know, sometimes those small changes can help as well, don't you think?
Yes. Even just a small tweak can change our perspective in a way that feels liberating and enjoyable. To me, joy and pleasure are the point. You know, that's what we're doing here. And I think we all deserve to orient ourselves more towards like genuine joy and pleasure. So not the same kind of pleasure as like, mainlining popcorn in front of Netflix. Like,
yeah.
That's not pleasure, right? That's numbing out. That's, you know, and that's also fine. Rest is great. Rest is essential. And, When we think about pleasure, to me, it's about like what lights me up, what lights you up, what makes us feel like, okay, I'm alive in this moment. There's a vitality, there's joy, there's a zinginess, a pleasure. That's that pleasure as well.
Yeah. Like for me, I feel like it's a sense of freedom. I think when I'm doing my art, it's a sense of freedom that I get when I'm doing it that I don't get with other things.
Right.
So I don't know if I'd always say joy. It's always fun afterwards, but it's just in that moment, it's a sense of freedom and a sense of being in my own world or my own little capsule.
That's a beautiful way of putting it.
Yeah.
Thank you for this question, Miranda. It's a great one.
It is. I'm sure lots of people will connect with this with this question. There's a lot of people go through it, don't they?
Absolutely, yes. All right. Thanks again, everyone. We'll talk to you next time. If you like the Creativity Cafe podcast, please subscribe and share it with other people who you think might like it too. Subscribing means that you never miss an episode, which means that we get to share all of these delightful conversations with you, knowing you'll get to hear every single one. You can subscribe by going to the show page on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts, and then just tapping on the plus sign or clicking on follow. It really helps the pod for you to do that. While you're there, if you'd be willing to leave us a rating and a review, we would love to have that too. We love to read what you think and hear your opinions, your thoughts, your feelings about the Creativity Cafe podcast. So please do go and leave us a rating and a review. Thanks, everyone.